So it's just a matter of timing. I think the you know, the reductions that we're talking about bring dollars immediately back into the city and the taxing jurisdictions. But to expand essentially site of North Mac, we're investing new dollars. So those dollars are coming from somewhere. And so that's the period of time where we're really, relative to the status quo, we're taking new dollars from the taxing jurisdictions. That's a choice that I think is being asked of city council right now. But that's where that comes from. And then long term, you have the payback of those expenditures. And much of it comes from the education urban renewal area. If you want to know where you get the long term positive benefit of the taxing jurisdictions, it comes from taking the education urban renewal area out of urban renewal.
Pat, what interest rate did you use to get the present value?
I think we used a 5% rate.
And could the city budget office remind me when's our big bump with the FPDNR obligations? Maybe that's a question you can get back to me on.
When you say big bump, I'm not sure.
When are we going to be most squeezed in our fire and police retirement obligations?
Okay, we can get back to you on that. It's over the next 20 to...
Yeah, that's. I'm just worried that it's at the same time that we're
going to
have that other big impact.
Better.
Except in the 26 to 30.
Right, but overall, this makes that better. It's a really long-term curve. It's a question of when the top of that curve gets closest to the ceiling
right. That
we're allowed to assess, and that moves around.
So Patrick, correct me if I'm wrong, but that negative number isn't spending money out of losing money. That's, as you said, compared to the status quo. And that five-year period is roughly the periods when the Central East Side and North McAdam would have come back on the tax rolls.
Yeah.
So there would have been a bump there. That negative number just means that bump that would have occurred doesn't occur then.
Correct.
Because we're both accelerating it in the early years and we're increasing it in the later years. So it's not like we're losing money in that year. The money that we would have got then from them coming back, we're getting earlier by defeasing some of them now. Is that accurate?
Yeah, no, I mean, this is money that's not currently flowing to the taxing jurisdictions. We're just extending the period of time.
Yeah, but no, Ed's point is this is not total impact. This is total change.
This is change. This is change relative to the status quo. Right. Carl, just Tony and I just conferred on this. It's actually a 3% discount rate that we're using on this, not a 5%.
Patrick, do you have is the impact of the extra 15% on the River District part of your discussion when you come back on the budget piece?
Yeah, I mean, we can show you the 5-year forecast for the River District and what changes it has in that.
But you've previously briefed us on, you know, at 15%, what projects might be at risk or how that might move.
Yeah.
Do you have an updated, does that updated view, if it was 30%, come to us?
It really doesn't impact the budget. I think what happened was we took a look at what we needed to get to the maximum indebtedness in a certain period of time, and we could take more than 15% without having any impact. So it's really not a PDC budget or PDC project. It doesn't have impact on that, other than to the extent of perhaps timing that they talked about earlier, and that. But timing has not been a problem in the district anyway, because we're still sitting on cash.
So, Mr. Chairman, when we come back to talk about the budget and the specific priorities within that district, the extra 15% does not impact decisions about Centennial Mills directly or post office directly or other investments in the pipeline?
Well, so it doesn't. The five-year forecast will have a minor adjustment, so it doesn't dramatically affect resources in the first 5 years. It does. It probably will change things after five-year period. But I don't know that we could simultaneously take on Centennial Mills, post office, Union Station, all those things at once. So I think we're still talking about sequencing some of those. But thankfully, they're not all happening at the same time. So.
Yeah, and I'm not suggesting I'm advocating for all those investments.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that I'm tracking the connection between early defeasance and budget options within the district. And does it change? It may not. But that sounds to me like you're going to flag that at the budget discussion.
Yeah, we can come back with more clarity on that. Yeah, there's basically a recast River District budget, that fund, from what you saw last year anyway. So we're going to have a pretty extensive conversation about that budget about that fund on the 14th. So the only thing before I flip to the next page is just we do have 2014-15 on here. As the mayor mentioned, if we act quickly, we can actually get the $1.8 million on to the city general fund for 14-15. The county and the other taxing jurisdictions will benefit from that. On the housing side,
let me stop you there for a second. Just a flag here. Acting quickly means the council reaching agreement that we want to do that, do this month, and PDC sending different instructions to the county assessor right by May 5th.
But is that mayor? Is that limited just to the River District URA?
Yes, but that's the piece of this that produces revenue right in the current year.
So it's not the whole package. It's
whole
we
package.
Act quickly on the defeasance in the River District URA. We get the extra bump.
We're not going to get any amendments through by the end of this fiscal year. But if we have clarity on the path forward, we can send our instructions to the county for Waiura and for River District. Can be we don't want anything from Waiura, even though it's still
from
technically
what?
We don't want any money
from Willamette Industrial.
Sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry, the acronyms. And then we're going to give you specific instructions on how much we can take from River District.
So you're just saying the decision point and the opportunity here is limited to the two districts and the
right
proposal, not to the overall package.
We don't have to implement right the whole package by right May 5th, but if we want to not collect those taxes this fiscal year, we need to tell the county yeah assessor by May 5th.
Yeah. Okay.
We pay particular attention to the impact of these changes on housing, on the set-aside, and so we've aggregated the different impacts relative to the status quo, once again, as I'd mentioned, to the Housing Bureau. The main impact, obviously, on the negative side is the dollars that would have flowed to PHB from the education or renewal area, and then you can see the positive impacts from both Central East Side and North McAdam expansion. So there is, different ways to make up for it. What's important to point out is that the education urban renewal area, all the funds were really backloaded. So much of the money flowing to PSU, flowing to PHB, for other projects was really, you can see the large numbers were happening 10, 15 years out. And so much of the value was coming in those out years. So we are not matching that in absolute dollars. But from a present value standpoint, we're more than making up for it because the dollars that would be available for housing under this plan would come sooner than in the education and renewal area.
But Patrick, isn't the big piece of information in this chart that you're folding in the additional $20 million for interstate?
Correct. We've added the $20 million that will be part of the requested budget for interstate, and then we've also taken out the proposed swap of $6 million in the convention center. Yes, but that does impact this positively.
It's still a positive $2 million net present value change without that.
Yeah.
And that just makes it look a lot bigger, but these other package changes still, because as Patrick said, the money comes sooner, it buys more. It's a $2 million to the good net present value calculation.
And you're going to give me a list of the $20 million and what's not going to get done that was previously going to get done?
Yes, and we can, on the 14th, we'll come back with the draft interstate budget as well on that. So the now, Chris,
one more question. The $25 million in 21-25 in North Mac. So we've done half of our commitment to South Waterfront in terms of affordable housing. That was Gray's Landing. That met two of the 200 towards the 400 units we've promised. One of the hopes was that through other development in the district, we generate more increment, and then we'd be able to fund the next phase. Are you making any assumptions in terms of the $25 million that's generated here? Is this based on the development you see in the pipeline, or is this based on some more conservative set of assumptions and just a third of it?
It's based on a set of assumptions about what kind of development we expect to see in the district, but it falls on the conservative side. That's typically how OMF likes to treat South Waterfront, because much of the projected growth would come from new development. So that's been the philosophy there. Tony can tell you.
But just to put the focus on it. If there were a major new investment in a cancer facility or something else
private
down there, that would be new increment, correct?
Yeah, I mean, so the increment available in North McAdam is greatly dependent on the density and value of development that occurs within those 50 acres, both on the OHSU side and the Zidell side. So lower value development or more non-taxable development results in less tax increment financing. Denser development, more commercial, private development results in more tax increment. So it really is.
The only point I'm getting at here is if our greatest hopes come true and Zidell develops his site and there's a major new cancer facility and other things, you're actually going to be generating a lot more for housing, which once you've fulfilled the pledge to 200 more units in South Waterfront,
yes,
could be available for partnerships with PSU, for example.
Yeah, our hope is to exceed the numbers we have on for North Mac. Yeah,
and Commissioner Fish, I think that's a particularly relevant question for North McAdam, because right now, even with the five-year extension, PDC is not projecting that they can hit maximum indebtedness there. So if those best aspirations you're talking about happen and there's more development, it gets us closer to hitting the maximum indebtedness, which means more for all those other uses because there's a 30% set aside of all that increase. So it's a really relevant question for North McAdam.
Thanks.
So on slide six, this is a comparison of the different estimated repayment dates for all the urban renewal areas. And you have three different options on here. One is absolute early defeasance. That was the beginning of our conversation a year ago on this topic, is what would it look like if we defeased all of the urban renewal areas as soon as possible. So that's that top bar. The middle bar is what it looks like with the mayor's proposed changes. The final bar is what it's currently projected to be under the status quo. So as you work your way down from the top, the first four, we're done. We have no ability to change the defeasance date on those. Those are done. Those districts, the bonds have been issued, and we're paying those off. The next one, Willamette Industrial, we have no debt issued. The defeasance date on that one, the 2024, was if we kept going with the district, but that one can end immediately. So that's why 2014 is the date. Central East Side, that's where we're asking for five more years. So you can see that the 2022 defeasance date would be extended. It doesn't extend by 5 years, but it's that's a result of us extending the date out. Same thing with North McAdam. We would be taking another 4 to 5 years to pay off bonds. Under the River District, which we'll talk about in a second, we could defease as of 2018. We could shut the district down. Under the status quo and the mayor's proposal, we would defease those in 2025. And then I haven't talked about the neighborhood urban renewal areas, and I just want to make sure that everyone understands. We've taken a look at the neighborhood urban renewal areas, each of them. As Katie mentioned, we have a lot of work to do. We want to continue to do that work. They each have resources, so we're not proposing any changes to those neighborhood urban renewal areas, but you can see what would happen if we were to, how quickly we could take them on back to the tax rolls we wanted to. I don't believe there's any sentiment to do that. The Neighborhood Prosperity Initiative districts are urban renewal areas, as Andrew mentioned. We basically could unwind those. I don't believe there's any discussion of that. And then the Education Urban Renewal Area, because we are still dealing with some obligations like streetcar, we wouldn't be able to shut the district down right away. But 2016 would be when we could shut it down. And I think what's striking about this graph is that, one thing is not like the other. It's the defeasance date for the education urban renewal area. It really is. It does extend the life of urban renewal, of this generation of urban renewal, well into the future. And so, if a objective is to shorten that, that is the one that takes it farthest out into the future.
Could you speak to lengths, interstate and gateway, or what the intended impact is there?
So this wouldn't have any change on that. There's no amendments
to
it. So we
can. Top blue bar is purely theoretical. It's really
that's a theory. That was okay. If we looked at all of them, when we could pay them off. But like I said, I don't believe I've been in any room in any conversation where anybody suggested anything to change that. I feel like I'm running over here. So this is chart's probably more confusing than it needs to be. But basically, this tries to compare what the impact is, the long-term 40-year impact is on City General Fund from the status quo or the proposed changes to urban renewal areas versus complete early defeasance of all urban renewal areas. And the way to look at this is the dotted line is what happens if you shut everything down. You get an immediate bump in City General Fund dollars, and then it kind of hits a certain trajectory. Under the two other status quo or the changes, you continue to forego immediate City General Fund revenues, but then as a result of the investment in TIF, you get a spike in revenues when those defease, and then you have a trajectory that is roughly similar to the early defeasance scenario, but is higher. And this is based on assumptions about what kind of changes in assessed value are generated as a result of investing tax increment financing. So that's the whole basis of this. There's a lot of assumptions built into this. So I don't think we need to spend a lot of time analyzing this. I think Commissioner Novick has some important questions about this type of philosophy in a second about spending dollars now that you would have now on priorities or taking the long-term incremental benefit of tax increment financing. I think those are two different viewpoints, and depending on what assumptions you use, you can make your case for either one, I think is probably the conclusion from this graph. So now quickly, River District. Commissioner Novick has in particular asked about the shutting down River District at the earliest possible date, which, as I mentioned, is 2018. And before I get into that, since you know part of my job is to advocate for some of the things we're doing, is just to remind what the current priorities are for the River District. The River District feels like there's a lot of money left, and it is a lot of money, but it's not meant to just be there to kind of fund things ad hoc. It really is designed to fund a set of priorities, and it starts with affordable housing. The River District has the set aside has produced one of the highest concentrations of affordable housing anywhere in the city in the Pearl District. I think there's still a commitment to keep doing that. So there's significant dollars lost there. The mayor has articulated a very strong preference to take Old Town Chinatown to the next level. We would propose putting $50 to $60 million of River District money over the next 5 years into Old Town Chinatown. Significant catalytic projects that we can take on, seismic issues that we can take on. So that's another priority. Centennial Mills remains an obligation of PDC that costs $20 to $25 million regardless of what we do. So tear it down, it costs $20 million. Redevelop it, we probably would have to contribute $20 million or more. So it would be the obligation that would be outstanding if the River District went away, that we would have no way to fund. But then you have other projects like the post office. We own Union Station, and I don't know if Carmen addressed this the other day, but it's not a place you want to be during an earthquake. And it has much better potential than what it is doing right now. It's probably on the order of a $30 to $40 million redevelopment project. We don't really have the money for it, even with the River District, but we still could make a significant dent in that. And then the 10th and Yamhill Garage is also remains an outstanding question for the city that money is allocated in there. If you think about shutting down the River District, this is the way that graph looks. We believe that you get, well, I'll jump to the numbers that we've talked about with Commissioner Novick. If you shut down the River District in 2018 and then all that property returns to the tax rolls, by the time the district would normally defease, which would be the end of 2025, you would benefit roughly $72 million. So that's $72 million over a seven-year period to the good. So the city would have access to that. That's 2018 to 2025. So that's really the dollars that are in question. If the city would have shut it down between 2018 and 2025, it would have access to $72 million. That it really wouldn't have. I mean, I'm going to give you some other numbers that you would net out, but it's still roughly $70 million. Under the proposed changes to the River District, we are between over that same time period, but beginning now, 2014, through 2025. The rough math is probably about $10 million to the good, beginning right now. Plus, you have the benefit of the investments that we're making from the remaining dollars in the River District. This graph kind of tries to show that, but it's probably better just to dive into the numbers. Those are the numbers that we're talking about. We also have the issue of setting aside dollars to pay off the bonds, because we can't pay off the bonds in 2018, as Jonas just talked about. So you probably would have some interest costs as a result of that, of sitting on that money. And so that brings the number down as well. But I think that's the general question, and I'll let the commissioner respond it from here, because it's really your question that you want to ask.
Well, I think that it's not really a matter of a question. There's just some points I want to make. I mean, I think that we should at least think about the possible benefits of shutting down any of these districts. Let's focus on the River District, because it's the one we shut down earlier, and it's a big chunk of money. I mean, I think that we need to be aware that the urban renewal districts take away potential general fund. And what Patrick was just saying is that if we restored the River District entirely to their regular tax rolls and started getting general fund in 2018, over the next 6 years, 7 years, we get $72 million. Now, that is not actually a real number, because Jonas will explain that we would be losing about $10 million through various financial machinations, so that actually brings it down to $62 million. And as Patrick pointed out, Centennial Mills is an obligation that we have that's at least a $25 million obligation. So I think that means that realistically we wouldn't shut down in 2018. We'd probably shut down in 2019, so we could use 1 year's worth of River District money just to tear down Centennial Mills. And then if you want to compare shutdown to the mayor's proposal, then back out the $13 million I think that we would get in new general fund from the mayor's proposal. And I'm losing track of my own math. When I did this earlier, I brought it down to $27 million in actual net difference between shutting down completely in 2018 and the mayor's proposal. And I just wanted to reflect for a minute about some of the potential liabilities we've talked about in the past couple of days, where for most of them, $27 million wouldn't take care of it, but it would make a significant dent. I mean, we've been told by facilities that there's $95 million worth of work to do in the Portland building. 27 isn't 95, but it's a significant chunk, and we don't have money set aside to fix the problems of the Portland building. We've heard that it would take $50 million to do all the work that we need to do at Mount Tabor Yard. $27 million isn't $50 million, but it's about half of it. And we don't know where we're going to get the money to fix Mount Tabor Yard. There's another potential city liability, that I stress the word potential, that we don't have money set aside for at this point. And with your permission, Mayor, I'd like to see if somebody at the table would yield to Jan Betts from the city attorney's office for about a 1.5-minute presentation on that other potential liability.
Yeah, but I guess let's finish up.
Okay.
And then do that, because I'm
all right. Okay.
No, I'm done. I purposely ended with the River District piece so that we could proceed into that conversation. So.
Okay. So sure, Jan, come on up. Unless there are any other questions for PDC staff.
Do we know what our potential liability is for Union Station for fixing that up?
The number I gave was $30 to $40 million. We can give you a briefing on what that is. That's our sense of what it would take to both redevelop the building and stabilize from a seismic sense. And we've been successful in slowly tracking federal dollars to do a bunch of this work. So we've been leveraging of late 4-to-1 our dollars, federal dollars. I just don't know how long that's going to be available to us. It really depends on transportation funding from the Fed. So we would try and continue to leverage money, but I think we're talking about that level of project, and I mean, it's a big liability.
Jan, thanks for coming down. Could you just briefly explain if there's any reason for us to be concerned about potential general fund bureau liability for the Portland Harbor Superfund cleanup? And I stress the cleanup, not the natural resource damages claim.
Sure. And that potential liability that could affect the general fund would be from historical ownership and operation of properties in the Portland Harbor Superfund site over the last 100 plus years. We don't know what those are yet, and it'll be some years before we do know, but there certainly is the potential for liability that could affect the general fund.
And what's the range of potential costs of the cleanup based on the most recent information we've gotten from EPA and from the Lower Willamette Group?
The current range, which was actually estimated 4 years ago, is from about $200 million to $1.7 billion for the cleanup.
That's not all ours.
No. That's the entire cleanup for the entire site. Thank you for making that point.
And I mean, I realize that we will fight hard against any claim of liability from any part of the city, but just to be doing the math, if it so happened that we were held liable for the general fund bureaus for 1% and it was $1 billion, that's $10 million right there.
That's right. That's the higher math. That's what I come up with. Yeah.
Thank you, Jan. And obviously, sure, we're not going to go into a detailed discussion of what the various claims might be, but I just wanted to make that point that this is another potential liability out there that we don't have money set aside for.
Okay. Any other questions for Patrick and team on the PEC issues? Sorry, didn't have my mic on. So again, we'll follow up on the questions,
yep,
that have been asked. Might need further time with Patrick and each of your offices on the questions of this package of revisions to the URAs, because again, the pressure that is on us in the short term is if we want to realize these benefits in the next budget year, we'll have to act in the next 30 days on part of this, not on all of it, but we'll have to know that we're going to do it and telegraph that literally to the county.
And we're actively working with PSU on agreeing on how we can make good on their priorities as well. Yep. So we should have some more clarity on that soon.
Okay.
And did you want to add, we've had a lot of discussions with the other affected folks. Portland Public Schools has looked at this, and Multnomah County has looked at it several times. And we've even had the League of Women Voters in a couple times to go through it with a fine-tooth comb, and they're continuing to do so. So we're trying to get as much scrutiny on it as possible to make sure we thought through it all.
Okay, good. Thank you all very much.
Can I, since if Leah's up next, can I just want to put in one plug, because the mayor mentioned this economic development strategy that's not just about PDC. So Leah's going to talk about the freight strategy. And I just want to say, when we think about economic development, that's a broad set of responsibilities the city has, and having a way for freight to move in out of the city is an incredibly important priority for us. And we talk about areas like the Central East Side, Rivergate, other areas. It's vital to us. So from an economic development standpoint, I just want to say it's important stuff that what PBOT's doing, and it is an example of how all the bureaus contribute to our economy. So thanks.
Good. Thank you very much. Okay, Leah, you're on.
I doubt anybody would object.
Is that okay, Andrew?
However you'd like to.
All right, good afternoon. Again, Leah Treat, Director of the Portland Bureau of Transportation, and I am joined by Art Pierce, our Director for Planning, and we also have a special guest.
Deborah Dunn.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you. So we have a a request in to you for one additional FTE, and this includes the salary and the associated overhead for the FTE to dedicate to freight and export issues. It's important to us to allocate additional staff resources for planning and project development to support economic development, to invest in our freight infrastructure, and it's vital for maintaining our healthy regional economy and remaining competitive as a global trade gateway. Between 2003 and 2010, export volumes increased 109%, created over 45,000 new jobs, and made Portland the second fastest growing export market among the 100 largest metropolitan areas in the U.S. So for every $1 billion in exports, an average of 5,400 new jobs are created. The request also supports the goals of the Greater Portland Export Initiative led by the Office of the Mayor and the Portland Development Commission to double the Portland region's exports in 5 years and add 113,000 family wage jobs. A key component for achieving the goals of the Export Initiative is to provide the needed transportation infrastructure and programs to support the efficient movement of freight to and from key industrial employment centers. The actions identified in the Portland Sustainable Freight Strategy are the roadmap to the City of Portland supporting greater exports and creating thriving industrial employment areas. These projects and programs will have a direct impact on the economic growth of the City of Portland and the region and will generate increased taxes for the general fund.
How many people do you have working on freight issues now?
One.
And how would adding somebody else help if we don't have any money for the infrastructure?
I can jump in. So we have a large amount of goals, and some of the things that can result from those goals are infrastructure that's expensive. Some of them are small wins that we have not been able to cultivate the relationships adequately with the freight community to really pull those out and figure out how we can move those forward. One of the key initiatives, and I think PDC already highlighted that, is that we could partner directly with the economic cultivation staff on PDC side to really have targeted conversations with those small exporters that are working to grow their businesses and work on figuring out what the exact targeted actions that can really help them. At this point, we have a lot of what we're calling the makers and doers in the Central East Side and in Lower Albina that don't have the sophisticated logistics support internal to themselves, and so this is able to provide that direct relationship perhaps to those potential exporters to help them figure out how to make their business more effective.
How many people are in the planning section now?
Total? We have 8 staff, including the freight planner.
Can I also add, I'm sorry, Greg just made a really good point that I think that's worth making. With our limited planning staff, we have very little ability to get plans ready and on the shelf. And a lot of the money that we depend on are federal grants, such as Tiger grants. And we will not, those require you to have shovel-ready plans. So we need additional staff supporting us getting those plans ready for us to be able to apply for those types of grants.
May I also add something? We've seen pretty generally over the last few years that there's been opportunities for better coordination between the active transportation side of PBOT and the freight side of PBOT. Many times there are some projects that we could all kind of work through some of the details, and we might have an even better project. So some resources for coordination would be really valuable for the city and for all modes of transportation.
Is this the $100,000 special appropriation request? So what would be the salary for this person?
Approximately, they would, I think, in the $70,000 range, like that, I think is sort of a mid-level planner.
So $100,000 is a total compensation number?
Including overhead. Right.
Yep. Overhead, pension, all that.
Yeah.
Correct.
Benefits,
yeah.
I had the opportunity a couple years ago to help work on a sustainable freight strategy. Would this position help advance some of those things?
Very much so. We have Bob Hillier here, who is the current freight infrastructure of PBOT, and one of the things he's very proud of is that specific product and the potential for that to really move the conversation forward, but really feels like he could really use some more resources to help make that happen.
If I could just jump in here. Over the last 3 years, I've been the chair of the Portland Freight Committee. And in my day job, I'm the president of the Oregon Trucking Associations. But today, I'm really here on behalf of the Portland Freight Committee. And over the, as I mentioned, over this period of time, we've seen, you know, a real void in our ability to execute some of the plans that are already in place, whether it's the Portland Sustainable Freight Strategy or the Portland Master Plan, or even in thinking about the export goals that we have, if we're going to double those in 5 years and really increase the number of jobs that we're seeking for this community, we need some resources. You know, $100,000 is a very small amount, and you know, you think about how much can that really achieve. But if we looked at what our priorities are, I think we could, I think we would find we could really leverage another person in the areas we need it the most. OPB the other morning mentioned that we were 70, we had regained 70% of the jobs that we had lost in 2008. So we're still a ways from getting our community back to where it was. So anything we can do to increase jobs is going to be critical. We have a whole list of things that this person could do, but we are not going to micromanage them. But we have already provided that as input to Commissioner Novick as well as the department. So thank you.
I believe that 70% number was statewide.
Yes, it is.
Here, 100%.
Okay.
I stand. We're happy about that.
Okay. We need to start pulling up the rest of the state even more.
I hope they appreciate us. Okay, other questions for this team on this item?
I have a question. Okay. When I hear family wage jobs, I salivate. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, I noticed that both of the proposals for increasing export, none of them mentioned East Portland, and yet we're very close to the airport and right on a very a transportation node. We are a transportation node. Can you explain why that is?
I only know some of the story, but a lot of it is there's a lot of infrastructure happening in East Portland in terms of investment in freight, but it may not be where some of that product is being produced. And so some of it is it's navigating through that environment, but not originating from that. But we also have, maybe Bob, I don't know if you have comments on the East Portland significance in this conversation that you want to reference.
Thank you, Bob Lear, PBOT, Freight Planning Coordinator. Most of the freight moves through our major industrial areas, the Columbia Corridor area, Northwest Industrial Area, Central East Side Industrial District. So that's where a lot of the freight originates and comes and passes through that area. A lot of the jobs, a lot of the employment serves the East Portland area. So I think there's a benefit with that, with the port, with the jobs being provided in the industrial corridors, that there's access to people that live in the East Side. You know, for those jobs.
But okay. What you're saying is that they would export from different manufacturing areas that are in different parts of the city.
Right. I think the key is, of course, that a lot of that job base is in East Portland, and other parts of the PBOT agency is working on access to jobs types of initiatives in terms of producing easier ways for people to get to that work, or in partnership with TriMet in terms of job access through transit. This is really specifically looking at the goods as more than the people. This is looking at how we will move that product, and there's other parts of the Bureau that are really looking at the people needs.
Okay. Right. So what would be the, who should I be asking questions of? Because people in East Portland are interested in doing small manufacturing.
Sure.
But it would not be transportation then.
Really, we look to PDC as our partner of, you know, convening private interest in this conversation to help us with connecting with those private.
So can we get them back here? No.
So much of Leah's time already. But we agree with you wholeheartedly that we think East Portland is well positioned given our current infrastructure, the highway network, whatnot, and Gateway is an example. The Columbia Corridor stretches all the way east of 205, and we've actually done a fair amount of development in that part of East Portland. But even on the, on the Foster corridor, we look at that as a potential area for growth in industrial commercial jobs. We don't have a lot of large, as strange as it may seem, we don't have a lot of large industrial properties, particularly vacant industrial properties, even in East Portland. Lots of smaller properties, lots of properties that are small brownfields, given the current uses there. So there is a fair amount of work, but we're trying to find where we might grow the industrial base in East Portland. I would say right now, Foster is the most promising place for us, and the city has collectively worked together, BES and Parks, trying to deal with the flooding issues. But I think there's some promise on Foster, but we have work to do to make more developable parcels available. So that companies can locate there. The space that's available, that's real, real space right now is occupied. So there's demand for space, but we need to do some work to get more industrial land available.
And there's comp plan work going on to look at parcels that might be rezoned industrial in East Portland.
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? And do you want to talk about the Downtown Marketing Initiative while you're here? Thank you.
We also have a general fund request, and to fund the Downtown Marketing Initiative, or DMI. The DMI's main purpose is to promote economic vitality in the downtown area. The DMI is focused on securing convention business and tourism business revenue for the city by increasing license fees and transient lodging taxes. The revenues from the DMI that are increased are deposited into the general fund. These are worthwhile endeavors, and this request is not considered a criticism of the program. The basis for the request is a reflection of PBOT's Back to Basics campaign and realigning our resources with our core functions. Our transportation system, as I told you yesterday, is severely underfunded, and every dollar makes a difference. Through research of this program, we learned that the general fund has supported it in the past, contributing as much as 30% annually in the first 3 years of the contract. There's some basic facts about the DMI contract. It's administered through Travel Portland. It originated in 2009 as an amendment to the Travel Portland contract set up to promote, solicit, procure, and service convention business and tourism. And at its inception, DMI's main focus was set up to promote the downtown area after the construction of the Portland Mall Light Rail and other large capital projects underway at the time.
And I should note that, the city did strike something of a deal with PBA where they said that they were going to object to our raising the downtown hourly parking rates to $1.60 as long as the city made this commitment to the Downtown Marketing Initiative. So from their perspective, the city has an obligation to continue funding it. Our position is that since the benefits of that marketing flow to the city as a whole and not just to PBOT, that it's appropriate for the general fund to, given that we picked up the entire thing last year, we think it's appropriate for the general fund to start picking up the cost.
How much did the increase in the parking revenue generate?
I'll have to get back to you on that question.
But that was the deal, was that we had the support of the downtown businesses in order to be able to raise the parking rates in 2009, and then the revenue was going to go to that. So I understand that there's a big problem funding in PBOT, but that's what that money was for.
Okay. Thank you. We'll get back to you with a specific number.
Thank you.
You have a ballpark? Because that is sort of the whole nub of the issue here. This is the first time you've been asked for that figure? What's the incremental amount?
Our ballpark recollection is $2
million. However, obviously, we need parking revenue to fund everything that we do, safety projects, maintenance projects. It's fungible money. So the idea wasn't that we were only raising the parking revenues in order to fund the Downtown Marketing Initiative. It was that the PBA said that they would not object to our raising the revenues if the city as a whole was going to make a commitment to the Downtown Marketing Initiative.
And Steve, I just want to say, in terms of priority setting within any bureau, that's uniquely a council decision, and we and priorities change, and I appreciate the chance we're going to have that debate and discussion. But I just want to make sure I understand the basics of this issue, and then the council will do its will. It's the change that we made, the additional revenue that was generated by the change we did back in 2009 is about $2 million a year.
Greg Jones with Transportation. I believe we went from $1.40 to $1.60 an hour, and generally about a 10-cent increase in the rate generates about $1 million, so it'd be about a $2 million increase.
So it's about $2 million. And then what precise action did the council take? I understand the politics of it, but the council took some action. We passed an ordinance or a resolution where we said we would use a portion of that to fund the Downtown Marketing Initiative. Do you recall which?
So there was, in order for us to raise our rates, council has to act on those rates, and they do so as a part of all of our fees and charges annually. So council approved that increase through those fees and charges back in 2009. We've been looking for the language, the tie language between the commitment to DMI and the meter rate increase, and it wasn't in the actual ordinance, but it was in the negotiation process leading up to it.
So the other place we might look is, was it in the transcript of the discussion at council where it was, when it was discussed with council, was this linkage frame for council consideration?
We'll have to go back and look at those transcripts. We haven't checked that.
Okay, so I have to say that before I get to the question of priority setting, it's important to me to know what we committed to and are we intending to honor a commitment. I understand that we have the right to change our mind and negotiate new terms, but the threshold question for me is, what was the commitment we made? And that's important. And Scott, you keep raising your hand. Is that because you were involved in that?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Could we hear from you for a second?
Come on. Yeah.
And I genuinely am just trying to establish the basic facts before we make a judgment on this.
Sure. So I sort of started my civic involvement at APP, which was merged into PBA. And when this came about, it was actually not just an increase in the short-term parking, but it was also charging for parking on Sundays. Mm-hmm. And it was not PBA directly. It was the Downtown Retail Council that had real heartburn with that problem. So there were discussions made between the mayor's office at the time, Downtown Retail Council folks, and they ended up agreeing that they would go along with both the raise in the short-term rates and the increase on Sunday, actually parking on Sundays, for the funding of DMI. I'm remembering more like $2.8 million was what the number was. But that was kind of the trade-off at the time.
So, Scott, at least from your recollection, why were the two issues linked? Was there a concern that by raising the rates, fewer people would come downtown and park, and therefore the enhanced money for the Downtown Marketing Initiative was to compensate for that?
Right, yes. And frankly, Downtown Marketing Initiative was kind of, way back when it was funded by APP, you probably don't remember, but APP, a lot of APP funding came from managing the city parking garages. And so to help substitute for the funding that came through the management fees, actually some of the parking revenues was spent over several years to maintain it. That number became a very small number. We seem to go through economic cycles around here, and we had a couple of really bad years, and people were convinced again that we needed to strengthen downtown, strengthen retail, and then we needed to do something to bring people into the city, and by letting them know that the parking was available cheap and actually having a campaign around that would be quite helpful.
And was this intended, I guess I understand the linkage, but was it intended to be in perpetuity, or was there intended to be a phase-in period where you try to offset whatever the negative impacts of the increased parking costs?
it's never in perpetuity, obviously, because there are new economic circumstances and a new commission and new direction. So I would say that there was a long-term commitment, but I can't tell you that it was 30 years or 10 years or 5 years.
From a purely factual standpoint, and council did in 2009-10 pass an ordinance committing to pay $953,000 for 2 years. That was then amended in or extended essentially in June of 2010, which extended the funding for another 2 years through 12-13. And then in December of 2012, the city entered into an additional another sort of agreement to extend that for another 4 years through 2017. So it has been a series of sort of short-term two, and now four in terms of that.
So the council has, by action, agreed to extend the funding through 2017?
We've agreed to make those payments. That's right.
So to start off with, it was a third general fund and two-thirds parking revenue. And then in 2012, it was all parking revenue. And now it's being asked to be all general fund.
Yeah, the funding source on this has shifted over time. And I think prior to that, again, there were different funding sources as well for similar activities. So,
any other institutional memory about this arrangement? I want to add to the council's edification here.
We took over the program in 2000.
Who are you?
Jeff Miller of Travel Portland, representing for DMI. We took over the program in 2009 and worked closely with the PBA, PDC, as the program moved over to us, and we are obviously part of that agreement. I do want to clarify that none of these funds are used for convention or hotel marketing. It's all for downtown business marketing, and we keep those funds very separate. We then leverage with transient lodging tax to extend the reach of that outside of the region, but these are used strictly within the region to bring people downtown to work. So it's a very distinct program that then Travel Portland funds outside the region.
Jeff, do you think that the Downtown Marketing Initiative is successful in getting more people to shop downtown and therefore increases business revenues downtown and therefore increases business income tax revenue for the city?
Absolutely. I think the retail vacancy downtown is the lowest now it's been in many years at 4.6%. And I think the fall fashion, the holiday campaign, and certainly dining month, which was one of the most successful ever, we moved it from June to March just to increase business.
So, under the present circumstance, how much is the parking violations? It's quite a few million dollars a year, is it not? And where does that money go?
Parking violations?
Getting a ticket.
I'll have to get back to you with a specific figure, but it comes to PBOT.
There is a component also of retailers downtown validating, which I believe is about $1 million a year that retailers pay for parking for their guests downtown. As when I was a general manager at Saks Fifth Avenue for many years, it was a major line item in our budget to make sure that we could ensure that our shoppers were could park free in smart park garages.
I might add that the court citations, violations you're talking about are court citations, not the revenues from parking. The citations are split between the court and PBOT. And PBOT's portion of the violation fee that we receive back goes to pay a majority of the portion of our enforcement officers.
So I just wanted to, well, my concern is that this is all leading to some dance that's going to increase the meter rates downtown or increase the hours. And I'm very concerned about increasing the hours beyond 7 p.m. because you're hurting low-wage workers who work downtown in the bars and restaurants. And I think if you start playing around with increasing the hours on Sunday morning, you're going to get the churches really upset because that's when their churchgoers show up, is on Sunday morning. So I don't want to see this dance leading to any perturbations, I guess, on the hours of current meters and really on the rates of the current downtown meters. That's my 2 cents worth. And I want to keep Downtown Marketing Initiative funded. I'm open to how we fund it, but I want to keep it funded, but not on the backs of service workers and churchgoers.
Fair enough.
And synagogue attendees. Can I make a request just for some information coming out of this? Because as I understand the discussion, we're going to have a number of options. One is whether we continue to make this payment. Two is whose pocket it comes out of. And three is for what period of time. And four might even be at what level of reporting about the benefits. There's lots of things we're going to have to discuss. But I would request that PBOT work with the budget office to come up with just the essential documents that document the history of this. And that includes any written agreements, resolutions or ordinances, transcripts of council proceedings, whatever we need, so we can and I have great confidence in the chair's memory of this, but I just like to see the history, and then it certainly is the council's prerogative to decide whether you fund it and how to fund it, and I would like to see it funded, but obviously there's more than one way it could be funded. But I would like to start with what was the basic understanding we had, because I think that's the essential point of departure here.
Useful idea. Got a number of new players here, so that's duly noted, and we'll get these two bureaus to do that. Okay, now before we make the turn to the next section of our agenda, we have, speaking of citizen volunteers who've been at it for a while, we want to hear from one here briefly before we move on.
So, Commissioners, I said earlier it was the sixth opportunity I'd had to work on the budget with you, and I'm going to tell you this afternoon that it will be the last. My term ends in July, and I intend to step down from PDC at that time. It has been an incredible journey, and I have really enjoyed working with all of you, but I felt that it was only fair for me to let you know now so that you and the mayor would have a reasonable amount of time to find a replacement. And of course, the board is going to have to elect a new chair in June, and that's just around the corner. So I'm not going anywhere, so you can still call on me, and I will probably still be calling on you. But 5 years as chair of PDC has been quite an experience, and it's been a real honor.
Well, Scott, we'll have other opportunities to thank you, and I'm sure there are going to be some folks here who want to thank you. I do want to let the council know that I did threaten him with the stop-loss policy that kept my son in the Army for an extra year, but he said I'd have to deal with his wife if I attempted to invoke that, so I fear to tread.
We certainly appreciate your service very much.
Huge amount of time. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, Scott, the first question that came to my mind was, what do you intend to do with the 50 hours a week that you've now freed up?
I'm going to spend the first 50 figuring that out.
I mean, there was a time when Scott spent so much time in this building that we were suggesting that facilities actually bill him for the space, for some space or establish an easement. There'll be another time for us to express our appreciation for your service, but I can't imagine a situation, Scott, where we're going to be able to find someone to fill your shoes, and you've been an amazing partner.
Thank you. Thank all of you.
Scott, I'd just like to thank you for putting up with my endless questions about Memorial Coliseum.
that's not why he's leaving. So thank you, Scott. You're here. So let's cover the Venture Portland item, and then we'll take a brief break before we turn to the Complete Neighborhoods section. So who's going to cover Venture Portland?